We want to thank our sponsors of this special On Location visit to Normandy, France: DAV of Minnesota, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580, and Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. Right now, we are on location at Utah Beach here in France. And, of course, we're commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Joined by my co-host, the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, as well as noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. Gentlemen, on this beach, you know, one of the things that I really noticed different about this beach is there were some cutouts, and the terrain is just a little bit different as we're looking back from the water towards the land, not as high of ground that needed to be overtaken. But then there are some cutouts right off of the beach. And Doug, you were talking about the importance of this type of terrain and how it really helped with what the 4th Infantry Division needed to do as they came through. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and the terrain and the importance of it.
Sure. So Utah Beach, as you mentioned, doesn't have quite the dramatic terrain features as Omaha Beach. There's not the high bluffs and cliffs behind the beach. It's more flatter rolling ground. This beach has the 4 exits, the causeways that were necessary for the offloading of tanks, trucks, vehicles. This beach was actually picked out as a landing spot by Teddy Roosevelt Jr., the assistant division commander of the 4th Infantry Division, who saw that they landed at the wrong area of the beach. The tides had brought them further east than they wanted to be, but it actually ended up being fortuitous because a lot of the heavier German defenses were on the beaches that they had to cross.
And so, Dominic, when we were talking kind of about the positioning of beach, Utah is the westernmost beach, and then Point of Hawk is kind of in the middle, and then on the other side of that is Omaha. And, you know, although the infantry division landed in the wrong spot, you talked about the way in which the bombings took place here, which might have made it just a little bit easier for the landing. It wasn't as bloody as Omaha was. Could you just kind of describe the difference in the way in which this particular beach in this area was bombed by the Allied forces?
So, yes, this area, Utah Beach, was bombed differently than Omaha Beach, because the U.S. Air Force and the Royal Air Force bombed this beach, the long on the beach, and not as it was bombed at Omaha Beach. It was perpendicular
to the beach.
To the beach. So the time of bombing was very short at Omaha Beach, and here they had more time to bomb all along the beach. So when the seaborne troops arrived on the beach had been a little bit clear by the bombing. So, and the German defense have been damage here, so it was a little bit different.
And it was actually fortunate then, as Doug was talking about, that they landed more east of where they originally planned, but it worked out to their benefit to be able to get on quicker and, of course, start doing the offloading and bringing that heavy equipment in that would be needed so badly later on. So, Doug, I want to come back to you. And, you know, we like to bring in and talk about our Minnesota service members and how we can tie some of the Minnesota service members into what we're visiting and seeing here together. So maybe you can talk just very briefly about Ralph Yeager from Wadena, Minnesota, and maybe just tell us a little bit about what unit he was from.
Sure. You know, Ralph Yeager was with the 505th Parachute Infantry Artillery. Most of the airborne troops landed by parachute behind the enemy lines, but they also had a seaborne element. These were troops that didn't have the ability or the chance to land by glider. Ralph Yeager landed with a parachute, the 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment Artillery Unit on Utah Beach. He was a mess sergeant with the 82nd Airborne Division. a combat veteran of Sicily. He also jumped into Holland later in the war, and he was from Wadena, Minnesota, north central Minnesota.
And one of the things that you were sharing with us was, interestingly enough, right off the coast here on Utah Beach, there was a mishap with a ship. And that involved another Minnesota service member. So tell us a little bit about that ship and then that service member from Minnesota.
Sure. Ray Nagel was from Minneapolis, Minnesota, graduated from West High School, B Battery of the 321st Glider Infantry Regiment. He was on a troop ship called the Susan B. Anthony. About 10 miles off the coast, it struck a German naval mine. There were 2,689 men that were rescued from that sinking ship. And coincidentally, they didn't have a single loss of life when they rescued all of those men from that ship. Another man that served with the glider field artillery unit, they were offloading their howitzers and other equipment onto the beach. Sadly, the Susan B. Anthony also had a lot of equipment and gear on it that was necessary for the invasion. Food, ammunition, weapons, and most importantly, there was a great deal of medical supplies that were lost in that ship.
And it's interesting that you talk about the medical supplies, because that was a question I want to bring up to you, Dom. You know, often overlooked as we talk about World War II and the battle, you know, it was a man's war, but there were still many women involved in supporting the war in various roles. And there's a lady that you're familiar with who was a nurse and was here on Utah Beach. Maybe you can tell us what her name is and kind of what her role was.
Yes, her name was Muriel Kapler. She was from Brandon, Minnesota, and she became a nurse, and she was registered nurse at Northwestern Hospital, Minneapolis. And when on the 7th of December 1941, she heard about on the radio the tragedy at Pearl Harbor, she decided to become an army nurse. And she landed here on the 7th of June 1944 at Utah Beach. Unfortunately, all the field medical equipment was not there because it was in the ship that was sunk. So during 2 days, she stayed on the beach and helped the medics to take care of the wounded. And after 2 days, the field hospital was built on Breco, where we were this morning, on the field near the German battery. And then during a month, she operated and did some surgery on this field hospital, the 42nd field hospital.
Yeah, just a great testament to the significant roles, significant roles of our females, somebody who volunteered, wanted to join because of what she had seen, obviously, at Pearl Harbor and making a contribution in the best way in which she knows how, and that is to take care of people. And undoubtedly, she saved many lives. Yeah. And as you said, spent time then at that field hospital.
Yes, 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 many women decided to join army nurses, they have a little bit been forgotten after the war for what they did during the battle. And I think about some nurses who have been killed on Utah Beach, but also in Anzio in Italy. So I think they had a very important mission in World War II.
So as I, again, as we're looking here at the beach, at the grounds, the terrain, notable difference in the actual terrain, but still, Doug, a surreal sight to be out on that beach and looking at what would be in front of these troops as they landed.
You would find in front of the beach when they initially landed a very low bluff of grass up against the seawall, very easily traversable. Behind the beach, as we're looking at right now, there's a series of small bunkers. They're called Tobruks, and these were single positions that were had little machine gun nests in it, but they're not quite as impressive as the ones on Omaha Beach.
Well, just another fantastic site and opportunity to be here on Utah Beach and continue this commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day. This is Doug Wortham with Minnesota Military Radio. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580. The post is a pillar of the community and lives up to the vision of continuing service to our country through service to the community. American Legion Chanhassen Post 580 was formed in 1952 by World War II veterans. Sponsorship of our commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day honors their memory and sends a clear message that they will support veterans, service members, and military families of all eras. Thank you, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. We are on location in Pointe-du-Hoc in Normandy. And again, we're commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day. I'm joined by my two co-hosts, the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, and also noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. Dom, I want to start with you. You know, we're up here at Pointe-du-Hoc, obviously a high ground, but where are we in relation to the beaches where the Allied forces landed on D-Day?
So we are right in the middle between Utah Beach and Omaha Beach. Pointe-du-Hoc is near Grand Commissy, where there was also another battery. And this point, what we call in France this point, was very strategic because it was supposed to have four guns of 155 millimeters, which could have damaged or destroyed and fire on the ships in the ocean.
And Doug, Dom mentioned the strategic piece of Pointe-du-Hoc. And, you know, so as we're standing here right now, to the left of us is Utah. To the right of us is Omaha. So to the west and then to the east. Strategy, because not only did these guns, the four guns that were supposed to be up here, would be able to hit the ships, strategic for another reason as well.
Sure. You know, there were only at this point, you're looking at this pockmarked, crater-filled Pointe-du-Hoc. And at the time, we were only about 12 miles from Utah Beach, well within range of these 155-millimeter howitzers, and about 4 to 5 miles from Omaha Beach. The guns here, as mentioned by Dom, were positioned perfectly to lay down fire on these two beaches. The amount of casualties they would have caused on these two beaches would have been catastrophic for the landing forces. The capture of Pointe-du-Hoc was of primary importance, extremely strategic importance. It was the sole objective of the Ranger Battalion, the 2nd and the 5th Ranger Battalion, to scale these cliffs and to neutralize these guns to take away any danger that they would have posed to the two landing beaches.
And so, you know, when we watch the movies and we see the scenes, you know, here, the guns weren't here. And they'd been moved at some point in time. But that doesn't mean there weren't German forces here either. So there was still resistance.
Yeah, sure. You know, there were some post-war criticisms that the Rangers' assault and capture of Pointe-du-Hoc was unnecessary because the guns weren't there. When, in fact, the guns taken to a farm field about a kilometer back, about 3/4 mile back from Pointe-du-Hoc. The guns were there. They were still perfectly capable of firing on Utah and Omaha beaches. A couple of Rangers saw those tracks of those guns where they were moved to this farmhouse, went back with some thermite grenades, and what a thermite grenade does is it creates a very intense heat. They were able to put these thermite grenades strategically in the traversing mechanisms of the guns and make them inoperable. Another strategic importance was a road that paralleled Point de Hoc. The Rangers' secondary objective was to cut off that road so German reinforcements couldn't go from east to west. So not only were the guns strategic, and that mission was accomplished by the Rangers, but cutting off that all-important road from east to west was also their secondary of secondary importance, but that was also accomplished by the Rangers at great cost, I might add. So 220 Rangers scaled those cliffs on that day, and by the end of the day, only 90 of them were alive and unwounded to be able to carry on the mission.
And one of the Rangers that that made it that day is someone that I want to talk about because it has a strong Minnesota connection, and I want to set this up for you and provide just a couple of quotes, and you'd already alluded to this. This is from Ace Parker, who you'll describe here momentarily, but he did say that there was only one mission for the Rangers for the invasion of Normandy, and that was to secure Point de Hoc. And then he also had this quote as he was asked about his time during D-Day and World War II. He said, it was an adventure of a lifetime if you could live through it. And so that comes from Ace Parker. And how about if you tell us a little bit about him, Doug, and really, you know, where he's from in Minnesota and then what he did here?
Sure. You know, Ace Parker is one of those characters that comes along the history that's a larger-than-life guy. As a young man, his father was a doctor in South Dakota. But, you know, Ace was an adventurous guy. He rode the rails when he was a young man during the Depression. He worked for the Civilian Conservation Corps. He moved around the country quite a lot. He joined the military and ended up becoming a ranger officer in A Company of the 5th Ranger Battalion. What's Ace's Minnesota connection? Well, he spent most of his life in Anoka, Minnesota, raised a family, and had a good life there. The 5th Ranger Battalion was actually supposed to reinforce the 2nd Ranger Battalion at Point de Hoc. The idea was that Colonel Rutter, who commanded the 2nd Ranger Battalion on Point de Hoc, would have signaled him to come in that the cliff, the Point de Hoc was ready to be reinforced. But communications were a shambles that morning. Their communications equipment was waterlogged or destroyed on the beach. They did not have the capacity to contact the 5th Ranger Battalion and have them come in and reinforce them. So secondarily, the 5th Ranger Battalion moved on to Omaha Beach, and Ace Parker led his company across the sands of bloody Omaha and made it to the relative safety of the cliffs. Fortunately for them, they only lost one man crossing the beach. They were in such a position on the beach that wasn't as heavily defended. They were able to scale the cliffs and eventually make their way over to Point de Hoc.
And it was noted that maybe approximately 300 German soldiers up here on Point de Hoc. And of course, the Rangers, they had to scale that cliff to get up here to secure what they thought were, gun sites, which they later found out weren't here. But still, that resistance up here, and as Rangers do, as soldiers do, and as you've mentioned many times, the level of training and just their attitudes of getting through and accomplishing the mission, that really kind of motivated them to keep going.
Yeah, you know, they were in supremely physically fit men, and more importantly, as important as their physical conditioning, they had that mental toughness and attitude that any job can be done. You know, Rangers lead the way. They had the strength to be able to carry on a mission where men with a little less training or a little less of that spirit, that can-do spirit, might not have been able to accomplish what the Rangers did. Ace Parker wrote later on in life that his unit accomplished every single mission that they were assigned in World War II, missions that other units may have had difficulty in, and that was one of the things that Ace was most proud of, is that his Ranger unit always got the job done.
Yeah, and you had mentioned about the type of soldiers they had in the unit, and Ace talked about in his book, too, that if you weren't Ranger material, you were not going to stay around too long in their unit.
Yeah, you know, the Rangers were obviously an elite unit, and if you read Ace Parker's book, Reflections of Courage on D-Day and the Days That Followed, actually written by his two nieces, Marcia Moen and Margot Heinen, who interviewed their uncle extensively. He mentioned that there were Rangers that pointed out guys in the unit that weren't measuring up, they weren't taking the chances, they weren't sticking their necks out and doing what they needed to do to keep their buddies alive and get the mission done. And Ace quietly removed these men from the unit and sent them off to replacement depots to go to other units. So they were very protective of themselves, and they made sure, they demanded that same level of commitment from their buddies as they had for themselves.
Yeah, just a another example of, you know, how Minnesotans have contributed throughout history, and the importance of Ace Parker and his team, and what they were able to do here at Point du Hoc in such a strategic location. Doug and Dom, another great segment, especially about Point du Hoc in this prime location strategically. Thanks so much for sharing your experiences, your knowledge here about Point du Hoc. This is Doug Wortham with Minnesota Military Radio. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, DAV of Minnesota. With more than 19,000 members and 32 chapters across the state, DAV of Minnesota was built on the concept of veterans serving veterans. DAV of Minnesota provides a network of services and leads the way to provide a lifetime of services to veterans of all military branches and eras. DAV of Minnesota fulfills our nation's promises to the men and women who served. Thank you, DAV of Minnesota, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio, and we are here commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day, recording on location at Omaha Beach. I'm joined by my co-host, the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, as well as noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. So, gentlemen, we're standing here right in front of a memorial for the 29th Infantry Division, a National Guard division. I'm looking out at Omaha Beach, and we're seeing that the tide is out. And just trying to imagine what it might have looked like on that day. And as I turn around, I do see the steep terrain that these Allied forces, our soldiers, had to maneuver up the beach, through obstacles, and then finally up this terrain. Can you just describe this, Doug, what this Omaha Beach was and really what took place here?
Boy, you know, it's really hard to imagine what took place here all those 80 years ago. You're looking at this beautiful expanse of a beautiful beach that extends for about 5 miles. Beautiful sloping sandy beach, and behind us are the cliffs above. We're at the Vierville Draw right now, one of the main exit points for Allied armor and vehicles off the beach, protected by these massive German gun bunkers that had lines of sight right down the beach, with all of these bunkers that were sited along the beach and not out into the ocean. They had what was called enfilading fire, so they were able to hit almost any point that an Allied soldier would be landing on Omaha Beach. Up on the cliffs, we see German gun bunkers built into the cliffs, machine gun bunkers, mortar pits, riflemen, rifle pits. Really a tough nut to crack for these Allied soldiers landing on the beach.
Dominic, as we look across the landscape here, and, you know, Doug was talking about the guns, they're in the terrain, very difficult to see, earth covering these guns. From this location, what is the expectation of the number of guns you think were just covering Omaha Beach in this 5 mile span? We're standing right here by a bunker. It used to be there's a gun in here. We can see that. And from our vantage point, there's a gun here. There's another one there. Yeah. How many more along this beach do you think that there were covering this whole land?
Oh yes. There were some other guns on the top of the beach, on the cliff, and there was other bunkers on the other side, on the 7 kilometers of this long beach, which was really well defended by the German. And there was mortars, there was machine guns everywhere on the top of the hills. And it was a very difficult mission for the Americans to land here.
And as Doug was describing, these are camouflaged very well.
Yeah.
So for the Allied forces to be successful, they had to try to bomb at least what they thought were sites. What's your thought about the success of that, of actually targeting and pinpointing and finding these guns?
I think it was very difficult for the Air Force, for the Navy to hit the guns. And in fact, the planners expected 75% of casualties on the first wave, which was a little bit less. It was around 50%. But it was a very difficult mission, probably the worst mission of on D-Day to land here at Omaha Beach. And that's the reason why there was so much casualties and became Bloody Omaha.
Yeah, Bloody Omaha. And Doug, back to you. You know, obviously, the Allied forces landed here, but we have some Minnesota connections, too, to Omaha Beach. And maybe you can kind of bring us full circle and talk a little bit about one of our Minnesota service members that was here on D-Day.
Sure. You know, right out in front of us, and I know our radio audience can't get a picture of where we are, but we're on the Vierville exit, and the 2nd Ranger Battalion's Armored Vehicle Unit landed here. It was commanded by a Minnesotan named Conway Epperson. Conway Epperson was from Minneapolis, landed here with his half-tracks to provide fire support for the other Allied troops who were landing. But the amount of casualties they were taking and the difficulty of finding the German gun positions really slowed their ability to knock those gun positions out. So, because you're imagining, and you're on the beach here, and you're looking at anti-landing craft obstacles. You're looking at poles fitted with mines on the tops of these poles to trigger when landing craft hit them. There are so many different barriers to them even getting onto the beach that in some senses it was a real miracle that they were even able to capture this beach that morning because of all the stuff that they had to go through. It was a really horrific experience.
And the units that landed here, the Big Red One, the 29th, and you're talking about these obstacles. You know, previously we had discussed the planning. In your research, either yours or Dom's, in your research, do you think they really understood during that planning the gravity of the obstacles that they were going to encounter here?
I think they did. But I think they knew that it was something they're going to have to overcome, even though they knew it was going to be a really difficult task. These obstacles, these impediments to the invasion were there. It was just one of those things that they had to overcome. They didn't have a choice.
And Dom, you know, you've met a lot of people that were here on D-Day, both American soldiers, other Allied forces. In your conversations with them, thoughts about coming off of the landing craft, walking onto the beach, of course, immediately under fire, but seeing what we can see right now and that 400 meters in front of them, and then the big terrain, what kind of thoughts were you hearing from those people that you've spent some time with?
I think that the first thing that they saw when they opened the ramp of the landing craft, that the obstacle can be also a protection for them. That was the only protection they had on the beach. Few craters of bombs, but they didn't have a lot of protection. So first of all, they used the obstacle as a protection against the machine guns. And then many veterans used to say that some of them have lost their weapons in the water because they didn't land in the sand. Most of them land in the water because the ramp was open most of the time in the water. So, and they had a lot of equipment, and it was difficult to swim. And so a lot of equipment was loose at that time. But the only objective for them was just to try to survive, because it was a terrible fighting, and of steel and of bullets and everywhere, and yes.
And you had mentioned the projected casualties at about 75%. I think you said it was a little bit closer to 50%, but in number-wise, do you know what the number was lost here on Omaha, Doug?
I think an accepted figure for the total amount of Allied soldiers killed on D-Day was about 10,000. Mm-hmm. And I believe the number on Omaha Beach alone was right around 2,000. So the as a percentage-wise, the casualties on Omaha were far in excess of all of the other beaches combined. So.
Well, as a tie to, you know, one of our military producers with the Minnesota National Guard, of course, as I mentioned before, we are right here in front of the 29th, a member of a unit division in the National Guard, and just an unbelievable sight to just imagine, and just the feeling that I have of being here and trying to even understand what happened is just is something I don't know that I can do. And we'll continue the conversation as we move along and get to other points in history and tell some more Minnesota stories. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum. Located at Camp Ripley, the museum strengthens public understanding of how armed conflict and military institutions have shaped Minnesota's and the nation's experience. Minnesotans are mobilizing to build a new world-class military and veterans museum at Camp Ripley, opening in 2026. More information at mnvetmuseum.org. Thank you, Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. We're back here with Minnesota Military Radio, a very special recording, again, commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We're recording here. We've moved down the beach, Omaha, to what do they call Easy Red. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But I'm still joined by my co-host, the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, and noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. So, Easy Red. Why do they call this area Easy Red?
That goes back to the military planning when they're designating landing spots for the different units. Easy Red is just a code name for this particular section of beach. We were at the Dog Green or the Dog Charlie sector, Dog Green. Here we have Easy Red. We have beaches code name Fox. They were simply code names for the different beaches.
And Dominic, where we're standing here on location, up from the beach a little bit, one of the many bunkers that fortified and tried to protect this beach. Describe this for me a little bit.
So this bunker on Easy Red is situated on Le Ruquet, which is the local name. And this bunker was in charge to flank the east part of the beach. And it's a 50 caliber, it's a 50 millimeters gun, which was inside. And this position was really well defended by the Germans.
And you said that just up the road from here was one of the first, or if not the first, medical encampment set up.
Yes, just at the top of the hill behind us, the first American field hospital was set up on the day after D-Day.
Now, Doug, back to you. We want to make sure that we talk about some of our Minnesota connection. And we know that the forces had to get off of the boats And there's a couple of different landing crafts that were used to get to the beach before they departed, of course, try to make their way up. Let's talk about the landing craft, and you can share some stories about some of these Minnesota service members.
Okay, well, the particular landing craft that the veteran we're going to be talking about next was called the LCI, which is Landing Craft Infantry. A number of weeks ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing a 103-year-old naval ensign from Anoka, Minnesota, Stan Nelson. And he was on LCI 492, which landed troops right off the beach here where we're standing on Beach Easy Red. He landed elements of the 16th Infantry Regiment from the 1st Infantry Division.
And an LCI, is that what we would have seen on, like, Saving Private Ryan or one of those movies where the back door flips down? Is that what you're describing to us?
No, the LCI actually had ramps on either side of it, on both sides of the boat. The landing craft, the LCVP is a landing craft vehicle and personnel, and the Higgins boats were the ones that you, in popular culture, you see the troops landing off of on the beaches. They're the ones with the ramps dropped down from the front. If you're familiar with the movie Saving Private Ryan, when they were landing off of Higgins boats.
And so what else can you tell us about this Minnesota service member? You got to spend some time with them, 103 years old. I imagine you had some interesting conversations.
I did. Stan, doing very well, very hesitant to talk about his service on Omaha Beach. Do you know what he told me was that he landed troops here four times during the day, about 200 troops per landing, right off the beach here. His comments on the casualties were that the first boatloads of troops that he dropped off didn't fare very well. Their casualties were pretty extreme, and it was very difficult for him to talk about.
Now, one of the other landing crafts is commonly called a duck boat or a DUKW. Is that right?
Yes. It's, you know, anybody that's ever been to the Wisconsin Dells probably got a ride on a duck boat at one point. Those boats that were used for pleasure at Wisconsin Dells, it served a very important purpose here on Omaha Beach. James Mildenberger was on a DUKW that had radio apparatus on it, and at one point his DUKW was the only radio link to the command ships off of Omaha Beach. The command ships were controlling the invasion, controlling the flow of landing craft going into the beach. And their radios provided a vital link for the soldiers here on the beach with the command ships. And James Mildenberger was driving that DUKW that morning on Omaha Beach.
And so, Dominic, as we are standing here and we look out over the beach and we're talking about LCIs and these duck boats, I don't know if someone knows the exact number, but I'm just trying to get this picture of looking out and just seeing hundreds of landing craft coming in, bringing in all these Allied forces.
Yes, it's difficult to imagine today because it's so quiet to see all these landing craft, all these DD tanks, all these ducks, all these vessels on Omaha Beach, and all these troops coming from the landing craft. We must never forget that 43,000 men land at Omaha Beach on D-Day. So that was a two division, and it was a lot of men who land here. And so the beach seems to be big, but with all these vehicles, all these men, these soldiers on the beach, it must be really very difficult to move, and it takes a while to leave the beach. So there was a lot of confusion also.
So, Doug, there's another Minnesota connection here. This is a St. Paul native that was here on Omaha Beach. And maybe you can describe just a little bit about this next person.
Yeah, so Robert Hutch was a young man from St. Paul, Minnesota. He served with Easy Company of the 16th Infantry Regiment. A 21-year-old young man in charge of 30 other young men, 18, 19, and 20-year-old boys that were some of them experiencing combat for the first time, not understanding what was in front of them, not understanding what they had to go through. Robert Hutch landed here. Crossed the beach, landed with most of his platoon and most of his company lying dead in the water or on the sand. He was lucky to survive. Notably, in the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum's collections, we have some letters that he wrote home to his mother afterwards, telling her, "You don't know how incredibly lucky I am to be alive right now," and very briefly discussing, in general terms, what happened on Omaha Beach. Later on, when he was being interviewed about his experiences, he went into much more detail about the dangers and the travails that he was experiencing that morning.
So it's been 80 years. We're commemorating the 80th anniversary. And Dom, I mean, here we are. It's 80 years later. But these structures, I mean, they're still here. I mean, you can just kind of, when I'm here and I see it and I touch it, I can feel it. This is real.
Yes, that's real. It's always a lot of emotion when we come here and we see all these bunkers. They are like monuments of the battle, and they were here, and we are exactly where there was some American soldiers who fought here. We really try to do the best to preserve all these bunkers because that's a history, and that's very important for us.
Yeah, it's a history. It's that constant reminder. You know, we like to always say that freedom isn't free, and a lot of lives were lost here throughout the entire war, of course, but specifically on D-Day, what we're commemorating to have this liberation and provide back that freedom that that you all, of course, wanted.
Yes, yes, yes. After 4 long years of German occupation, the freedom was really very important for us. So we know the price that America and UK has paid for our freedom. So we must never forget what you have paid for our freedom.
Well, we are concluding this part of the show here from Omaha Beach. Just a surreal sight. I don't even know how to describe what I feel, the emotion and just the gravity of what took place here. We'll continue our conversation and our commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day. This is Minnesota Military Radio.